That to begin the captioning. All right. Sorry about that. I don't know if you were able to hear me, or if I was speaking to myself. Barry and Alan, are you able to hear me?
I can hear you, Peter. Thanks.
And I can hear you as well. Thank you.
Alrighty. I guess I was going through a rehearsal here. Welcome to the ADA Legal Webinar Series. My name is Peter Berg, Project Coordinator of Technical Assistance and Training with the Great Lakes ADA Center. The ADA Legal Webinar Series is a program of the DBTAC Great Lakes ADA Center on behalf of the ADA National Network. The ADA National Network is the leader in providing reliable information, guidance, and training on the Americans with Disabilities Act to businesses, government entities, and individuals. I want to welcome all of you to today's session, where we will be looking at the impact of ADA cases that were not dealt with under the ADA Amendments Act. The ADA Amendments Act of 2008, which went into effect on January 1st, dealt with two significant Supreme Court cases, but there were many other cases out there that were not addressed under the ADA Amendments Act, and our presenters today are going to talk about those other cases and the implications that they have had. With us today, for those of you who are regulars to our ADA Legal Webinar Series, we have Barry Taylor. Barry is the Advocacy Director for Equip for Equality. Equip for Equality is the state of Illinois' advocacy, protection and advocacy service. And he also supervises the legal services, self-advocacy, and training projects at Equip for Equality. Joining Barry today will be Alan Goldstein. Alan is a senior attorney with Equip for Equality, and he is also the manager of the Illinois ADA project. So with that, I will turn it over to Barry and Alan to take us through today's session.
Hi, this is Alan talking. Thank you, Peter. Sorry, there's been some technical issues, but I just pulled the slides back up, and hopefully everyone can hear me and we're working okay. If there are any problems, if you can type it in the little box, I should be able to catch that as I'm going. Otherwise, I'll be assuming that everyone can hear what I'm saying. So again, we'd like to thank. We have over 80 participants today, which is great, and I know there are a lot of people listening who know the ADA very well, so I encourage anyone to ask questions or to correct any misinformation or to point out anything else they feel is relevant in this session, because we have a lot of people with knowledge of this material joining us today. And also, before we start, I want to thank two young lawyers at Equip for Equality, Rachel Margolis and Dan Spira, who helped Barry and myself in preparing the legal brief, which you will receive if you have not already, as well as this webinar. So I want to thank Rachel and Dan. We have here a picture of the current U.S. Supreme Court. And just a couple of observations before we get started. I like this picture for a number of reasons. The main reason is I just love how happy Justice Sotomayor looks in the back row on the right corner, the newest Supreme Court justice member. Also, I find it interesting that many of the justices are looking in different directions, which I hope is not indicative of the future direction of the court. And finally, the last thing I found amusing in this picture is Justices Scalia and Justice Thomas in the lower right in the front row are sitting closer together than any of the other justices, which some might say may be symbolic of their judicial philosophies as they agree on the vast majority of Supreme Court decisions. And again, we'd like to thank the Great Lakes DIPTEC for helping us put on these webinars, and we hope people are finding them useful. So the subject of this webinar are the Supreme Court decisions that are still good law after passage of the ADA Amendments Act. Many of you may be aware that the ADA Amendments Act explicitly overruled some Supreme Court decisions, notably the Sutton Trilogy and the case of Toyota versus Williams, but there are other Supreme Court cases that are still valid and are still enforceable and have value as precedent. So in this webinar, we're going to look at most of those Supreme Court cases, and we're also going to discuss lower court decisions that apply those Supreme Court cases. In the legal brief, which is accompanying these materials, it's a more thorough analysis where all the Supreme Court cases are included in somewhat more depth, as well as additional cases from the lower courts applying the Supreme Court precedent. So here's an overview of the cases we're going to be talking about. The Title I cases will be U.S. Airways versus Barnett, Raytheon versus Hernandez, Chevron versus Achazabal, Cleveland versus Policy Management Systems, and the Board of Trustees of the University of Alabama versus Garrett. Those are the Title I cases. Under Title II, we have Olmstead versus LC and Tennessee versus Lane. And then under Title III is Bragdon versus Abbott and the PGA Tour Inc. versus Martin. Some of these cases have been covered maybe tangentially in previous webinars, and we try to include information about other webinars that people can go to for more information on various topics. So now we're going to look at the Title I cases, and we have there an interior view of the oral argument room for the U.S. Supreme Court, obviously when court is not in session. So the first case we're going to talk about is U.S. Airways versus Barnett, which involves the issue of reassignment. In this case, a cargo handler who had back injuries wanted to transfer to a mail room because it would be a less physical position. And U.S. Airways had the policy of only allowing reassignment or transfer to vacant positions based on seniority, and Mr. Barnett did not have adequate seniority to bid for the position. So the question before the court is, would it be an undue hardship for an employer to deviate from their seniority policy? And I just want to point out in this case, it was not a collective bargaining agreement policy. It was a policy instituted by management, but I think the case applies to both situations. And the court held that indeed it would be an undue hardship for an employer to violate a seniority policy as long as that policy is consistently enforced. Then an employer does not have to deviate to place an individual in an open position who may have less seniority. However, the court did say that special circumstances might alter this fact. They said seniority policies fulfill the purpose of fulfilling employee expectations of fair, uniform treatment, but if there's special circumstances that mean those expectations aren't in place, then an employee may be able to be reassigned to a position even if they did not have the requisite seniority. And the Supreme Court pointed out what those special circumstances for the exception might be, and I quote, "The employer having retained the right to change the seniority system unilaterally exercises that right fairly frequently, reducing employee expectations that the system will be followed to the point where one more departure will not likely make a difference." But the burden is on the plaintiff to show that the seniority policy is in fact not consistently enforced. If an employer does consistently enforce a seniority policy, then that would trump reassignment. There's also some language in Barnett, and I quote, that preferences will sometimes prove necessary to achieve the Act's basic equal opportunity goal, which is an interesting statement. And one more thing I want to point out about Barnett is Justice Scalia, in his dissent, in referring to the majority opinion's discussion of special circumstances that would require a deviation from a seniority policy, in response to that, Justice Scalia said, "I don't know what this means." And now we'll look at some subsequent cases and see if we can shed a little bit of light on what that means. In Tobin versus Liberty Mutual Insurance, an employee with bipolar disorder requested additional support staff, and also he requested to be assigned to mass marketing accounts to increase business. The accommodation of the mass marketing accounts was not provided, and the employee was terminated for poor performance. They said he didn't meet the goals for sales. The employee said, "The reason I didn't meet the goals is because I did not receive the reasonable accommodation." Many of the cases we see are decided on summary judgment, but this case actually went before a jury, and the jury found for the employee, and the company appealed, and the jury actually awarded $1.3 million in damages, including $500,000 for emotional distress. And I think part of that's related to the fact that this was a long-term employee. Mr. Tobin had been with the company for 37 years, and the performance issues really only started to come up when a new supervisor came in, which we see in a lot of cases, and I think it really points to the importance of constant employer training so that all supervisors are aware of ADA requirements. The employee said that if he had been given the accommodations, he would have met his quotas, and that would have accommodated him for any limitations caused by his disability without altering the essential functions of the job. The employer, their defense was based on Burnett. They said, we only assign mass marketing accounts as perks to the highest performing agents. And they analogized this policy to the neutral seniority system in Barnett. The court wasn't quite convinced whether it was the same type of issue as Barnett, but they said even so, the exceptions in Barnett were applicable. The evidence showed that the mass marketing accounts were not only awarded as perks to highest performing agents, but sometimes were offered on a case-by-case discretionary basis, not necessarily for sales performance. They were given to new sales representatives or sales representatives who were not producing well in order to help jumpstart their business. And at trial, the managers admitted that they had the discretion to give plaintiff a mass marketing account, but they just chose not to do so. And the court and the jury found that in this case, that was a violation of the ADA, and the accommodation of providing those accounts should have been granted. In the next slide is Gomez Morales versus Pacific Northwest Renal Services. In this case, an employee requested transfer to another workstation as a reasonable accommodation, and the employer denied it, saying, we have a neutral policy that prohibits transfer of positions within 6 months of a disciplinary action. And the decision is somewhat sparse. It didn't really go into depth about what the disciplinary action was or all the reasons behind the requested transfer. But in this case, the Ninth Circuit relied on Barnett and said defendant has a neutral policy, and therefore, absent special circumstances, the transfer would not be reasonable. And in this case, it seemed that the employee really didn't present any evidence of these special circumstances that would warrant an exception to the general rule prohibiting transfer. So in this case, the employee lost, and the employer was allowed to follow their neutral policy that, according to the evidence, was consistently enforced. The next case is Dilley versus SuperValue, which involved a truck driver with a lifting restriction who requested reassignment to a route that did not require any heavy lifting. The employer said that it would violate its seniority position, even though this employee had sufficient seniority to get the position. The employer argued, well, in the future, a different employee with more seniority might want that position, and they should be able to have that position open for that new or for that more senior employee in the future. The court disagreed with that argument, saying that there was really only a potential violation of the seniority system. And in this case, unlike Barnett, this individual had adequate seniority to get the transfer, and the fact that someone later may bump him was not a reason to deny the transfer in the first place. And the court also went on to say that if there is a more senior employee in the future who wants that position, then maybe that employee would be bumped, but in the meantime, they should have been reassigned into that position. And in this case, also, that employee had a lot of seniority. There were only a couple of employees, the court noted, who would have been able to bump him anyway. So it was really more of a potential violation of the seniority policy than an actual violation of the seniority policy. There's one big issue on reassignment, which is still undecided. There's a split in the circuits. And the question is whether the employee, in order to receive reassignment to a vacant position, which is recognized as a reasonable accommodation, whether that employee needs to be the best qualified person for the job. So does reassignment mean they automatically get placed in the vacant position as long as they're qualified and it's available? Or does it mean that the employee just has the right to compete for that vacant position with everyone else who may be competing for it? The EEOC takes the position that the employee does not need to be the best qualified. As long as they are qualified for the position and the position is vacant, then they should be reassigned to that position as a reasonable accommodation. The point being, otherwise, reassignment would be of little value and would not be implemented as Congress intended, because anyone can compete for the position. As the court noted in Barnett, reasonable accommodations sometimes give preferential treatment to people with disabilities, and this would be one of those cases. So some courts do follow the EEOC's position, the 10th Circuit and the D.C. Circuit, that the employee automatically gets the position if it's vacant and he's qualified. Other circuits do not, notably the 7th and the 8th Circuit. And in fact, the 7th Circuit, in the case of EEOC versus Humiston Keeling, actually said that placing a less qualified employee into a vacant position would be what the court termed affirmative action with a vengeance, which again is contrary to the EEOC's position. So on this issue, it pretty much depends on where you live and which circuit's law governs reassignment for this issue. There's a query whether the ADA Amendment Act language regarding EEOC guidance will change how reassignment will be examined. The Amendments Act requires courts to give more deference to EEOC guidance than had been given in the past. So while it's possible that the EEOC guidance will be given more weight, because the ADA Amendments Act really is talking mostly about the definition of disability issues, it'll be interesting to see whether courts do give more weight to EEOC guidance or whether the courts that do not follow the EEOC's position continue to not follow the position. And this issue was almost settled. There's a case on the bottom, Huber versus Walmart Stores, which was actually appealed to the Supreme Court. And that involved the 8th Circuit, which meant the employee only has the right to compete for the position. And the Supreme Court agreed to hear the case, but the case was settled before the Supreme Court decided the case, so it is still an open issue and resulting in a split of circuits. Now we're going to move on to another case, Raytheon versus Hernandez. In this case, Mr. Hernandez resigned his position in lieu of termination due to drug use. He went through rehabilitation, but Raytheon refused to hire him because they said they have a neutral policy of not rehiring people who were terminated for cause. Now, we did a webinar a while back on issues of disparate treatment and disparate impact, and that comes up in this case. And the court held that employers applying a non-pretextual, neutral, no-rehire policy are generally not liable for disparate treatment claims. As you remember, if a neutral policy has the effect of discrimination, that should be a disparate impact claim. Unfortunately, in this case, Mr. Hernandez and his attorneys did not raise the disparate impact claim at the trial court. And therefore, it was only seen as a disparate treatment claim, and therefore Mr. Hernandez lost because the company was applying a neutral policy, and under a disparate impact analysis, the result may have been different. It's not clear. But this case is interesting for a few other reasons. Justice Thomas, in his opinion, said that there was no evidence that the decision was based on his status as a person with a disability. In disparate treatment, you're mostly looking for the motivation of the employer's decision. Was it done due to a protected status like disability? And with disparate impact, you're looking at the effect of a neutral claim. So here, using the disparate treatment analysis, because that was all that was argued at the trial court, Justice Thomas said there was no evidence that the decision was based on his status as a person with a disability. They just knew he was fired for cause, didn't know what the cause was, and then Raytheon followed the policy of not rehiring people who were terminated or resigned for cause. However, it's interesting, if you go to the appellate court decision back when Raytheon was called Hughes Missile System, and I have the case site down there in the note, the facts are actually slightly different than Justice Thomas said. Justice Thomas pretty much said that the employer had no knowledge of Mr. Hernandez, the reason that he left the company before, or his status as a person with a disability. But when reading the record of the appellate court decision, it turns out that when Mr. Hernandez applied to be rehired, he attached a couple of letters to his application, one of which was from a counselor who stated that he works with recovering alcoholics and drug users, and that Mr. Hernandez regularly attends Alcoholics Anonymous meetings, maintains his sobriety, and has a strong commitment to his recovery. So the record actually does indicate that Raytheon did have some knowledge of Mr. Hernandez's status as a person with a disability, despite the assertion in the majority opinion of the Supreme Court to the contrary. So sometimes it's very interesting to go back and read the earlier court decisions in these Supreme Court cases and see if there are some factual disparities in how they're relayed. The next case applying Hernandez is Bates versus United Parcel Service. In this case, employees who were deaf and hard of hearing were not able to pass the hearing standards imposed by UPS. The Department of Transportation has standards for trucks in excess of 10,000 pounds for hearing, and UPS decided to apply those standards for trucks over 10,000 pounds to people who drove trucks that weighed less than 10,000 pounds. So they required all drivers to meet the DOT standard, even if the trucks were smaller. And UPS claimed that that was an essential function, part of being a safe driver. And the court said, well, then we really need to see if the employees can drive safely. And we went to the business necessity test. If a rule has the effect of discriminating, the employer can still defend their rule by saying, yes, it might have the effect of discriminating, but we have a necessary business reason. Business necessity compels us to have this policy. And so in this case, it was sent back to the trial court to determine whether UPS did really have a reason that meets the business necessity test. And one thing interesting in Bates is it cites Raytheon to say that Raytheon stands for the proposition that the business necessity test applies to disparate treatment claims, disparate impact claims, as well as reasonable accommodation claims. And that's a correct statement of the law. The business necessity test can be applied to all three types of ADA claims. But actually in Raytheon, the decision doesn't quite correctly state the law. In Raytheon says, and I quote, the Court of Appeals further noted that the company had not raised a business necessity defense, a factor that pertains to disparate impact claims, but not disparate treatment claims. And that's actually a misstatement. The business necessity defense can arise for any type of ADA claim, disparate impact, disparate treatment, or failure to accommodate. So the appellate court kind of gave the Supreme Court the benefit of the doubt in terms of when the business necessity test should be applied, and it really can be applied to any type of ADA claim. And we have a note there on the bottom about the prior webinar on disparate treatment, disparate impact, and also regarding qualified issues, a separate webinar. Next, we have another Supreme Court case, Chevron versus Achazabal. In this case, Mr. Achazabal, who is an individual with hepatitis C, was not hired because Chevron considered him a danger to himself. And Chevron asserted that his liver condition might be exacerbated, might be made worse by exposure to toxins. Now, in the ADA statute, direct threat was only listed as including danger to others. But when the EEOC wrote the regulations for Title I, they included danger to self. So a direct threat could be a danger to others or the individual. And the question before the Supreme Court is, are the EEOC regulations valid because they expand on the direct threat defense? And the court held the EEOC regulations were upheld, and the danger to self is now recognized under the ADA as a defense under Title I. And I want to point out that Title I, and one implication is that many people in the disability community see that as kind of a paternalistic approach by employers. They feel if the employee feels a job is safe and their doctor feels a job is safe, the employer shouldn't come in and say, no, no, you're wrong, the job really isn't safe for you. But according to Echazabal, the employer can do that. But it's interesting to note that under Title III, and the Title III regulations were written by the Department of Justice, not the EEOC, direct threat only includes threat to others, not danger to self. And so there is an open question whether the threat to self-defense does apply under Title III or does not. And you can see here we cited the Solano case, which held that the threat to self-defense does not apply under Title III. And again, we cite the Great Lakes webinar on direct threat, which covers this issue in much more depth. In the case of Darnell versus Thermafiber, summary judgment was affirmed for an employer who did not rehire an employee with insulin-dependent type 1 diabetes. Under a pre-employment physical, which was given after a conditional job offer, the doctor giving the physical found that the diabetes was not under control, and in fact, the applicant admitted that he didn't really take care of his diabetes well. He wasn't sure the last time he saw a doctor and had other issues. And the court held that an employee is not qualified if his disability poses a direct threat to his safety or the safety of others, applying the Echazabal case. Court said that uncontrolled diabetes in a manufacturing plant with dangerous machinery could cause serious injury. As required under the direct threat analysis, the employer did rely on objective medical evidence and an individualized assessment in making its decision. And in fact, the applicant admitted that he did not have his diabetes under control. And then the next case is Claiborne versus Potter. In this case, a U.S. Postal Service employee sued, and remember, federal employees are covered by the Rehabilitation Act, Section 504, and this employee had retinitis pigmentosa, a progressive eye condition, which caused her significant vision loss, and after the employee had a few accidents in the workplace related to her vision, the employer had a fitness for duty evaluation, and then placed her on sick leave because the employer felt that she posed a direct threat to her own safety. And the employer, the Postal Service in this case, modified the employee's duties over time and eventually reduced her duties to only one task, that of stacking and clearing bins. And the court relied on Chevron and Darnell in recognizing the threat to self-defense and said that defense applied here due to the objective fact of the three separate accidents that the employee had at work, which shows that she was in fact experiencing some threats to her safety. In Taylor versus Rice, and this is a case I think we talked about under direct threat before, a plaintiff applied to be an officer with the Foreign Service, but he was rejected for that position due to his positive HIV status. And at the time, the State Department had a policy that prohibited hiring people with HIV for these types of positions under the thinking that they might need medical treatment that would not be available in a less developed country where they might be stationed. The trial court relied on Echazabal and found that the plaintiff would be potentially a direct threat to himself in such a situation, but that decision was reversed by the D.C. Circuit Court, the appellate court. And as you may remember, under the direct threat analysis, an employer has a duty to see if a reasonable accommodation would alleviate, or eliminate, or reduce any direct threat. And in this case, the appellate court held that there were accommodations that might reduce the direct threat so there was no substantial risk of significant harm. And in fact, Mr. Taylor had proposed two accommodations, one granting him Class 2 clearance and only placing him at overseas posts where they did have sufficient medical staff, where he can access local HIV physicians and diagnostic laboratories. And I have a query there that does this waive an essential job function? I think that's a little bit of an undecided question. But he had a second option, which I think made even more sense, which would be to send Mr. Taylor any post, but if he did need to get medical care, that he should be able to use his allotted leave time to access medical care. And the court said that send the case back to the trial court to examine whether either of these accommodations or another one would eliminate the direct threat. And then as a follow-up, in February of 2008, the State Department announced that it was lifting its ban on hiring people with HIV in the Foreign Service, thus eliminating that policy. Next, we're going to get to an issue which affects almost every Social Security beneficiary who puts forth an ADA claim. In this case, Mrs. Cleveland was terminated by Policy Management Systems, and after her termination, filed for Social Security, and also filed an ADA claim against her employer. And there's a question, and it gets into some technical areas of a legal principle called estoppel. An estoppel essentially means if a person makes one statement in a judicial forum, they should be prevented by asserting something totally opposite in another judicial forum. And the lower court had used estoppel to say that Mrs. Cleveland was not entitled to pursue an ADA claim. The Supreme Court reversed that decision and actually found a lot of cases or a lot of situations where a person who is a Social Security beneficiary could assert an ADA claim. And a lot of it revolves around the different definitions of disability under the Social Security Act and under the ADA. So the court found identified five reasons. One, the ADA considers reasonable accommodations in determining if someone is qualified, but Social Security law does not look at reasonable accommodations in determining if someone is disabled. The court also pointed out that there's differing analyses under each law. For example, Social Security has listed disabilities. If a person is deaf or blind, they kind of move ahead quicker in the process of becoming eligible for Social Security benefits. But clearly, that doesn't mean that anyone who's deaf or blind is not able to work. It's just part of their process related to the Social Security definition of disability. The Supreme Court also pointed out that Social Security has work incentives rules that anticipate that Social Security beneficiaries would be working. And shortly after this case came down, in fact, the Ticket to Work Act was passed, in which Social Security is seeking to have more of its beneficiaries, in fact, trying to double the number of beneficiaries who receive Social Security and are able to return to work. So Social Security Administration itself recognizes that people may collect benefits and still be capable and qualified for work. And the court pointed out two more reasons that people's conditions change over time and alternative pleading is allowable under the federal rules of procedure. And I also cite the Great Lakes webinar on qualified issues at the bottom. And here's some language from Cleveland. It says, pursued and received of SSDI benefits does not automatically stop the recipient from pursuing an ADA claim, nor does the law erect a strong presumption against the recipient's success under the ADA. The two claims do not inherently conflict. There are too many situations in which an SSDI claim, a Social Security Disability Insurance claim, and an ADA claim can comfortably exist side by side. And the court also said an SSA representation of total disability differs from a purely factual statement in that it often implies a context-related legal conclusion. So if someone says, I am disabled, to the Social Security Administration, what they're really saying is, I'm disabled for purposes of the Social Security Act. Going on, an individual might qualify, this is the Supreme Court talking, an individual might qualify for SSDI under the SSA's administrative rules, and yet, due to special individual circumstances, remain capable of performing the essential functions of her job. But the court said the plaintiff, the employee, has a burden to put forth one of those five reasons that we identified, and they must put forth a reason sufficient to warrant a reasonable juror's concluding that, assuming the truth of or the plaintiff's good faith belief in the earlier statement, the plaintiff could nevertheless perform the essential functions of her job with or without reasonable accommodation. And I think this legal factual distinction is very important. A statement to Social Security Administration, I am disabled, is really a legal statement saying I'm disabled under the rules of the Social Security Administration, the Social Security Act. But a factual statement, for example, I can't stand for more than 5 minutes, I can't lift over 10 pounds, I have trouble moving my arms, I'm unable to stay awake on the job, those are factual statements, and those types of statements made to SSA, to Social Security, may come back and haunt someone in an ADA case. And there was a webinar on this under qualified, and in the legal brief, there's actually two law review or law journal articles on Cleveland issues, and those are both referenced in the legal brief. So for people who want to do more Cleveland reading, please feel free and go ahead. And if anyone can tell me the picture of that young dude up in the right-hand corner, you get extra bonus points. So in the lower courts, and there's been a slew of cases under Cleveland, they've tried to apply those principles. So in Volts versus Arctic Cat, the employee applied for Social Security benefits at the suggestion of Human Resources, and he told Social Security that I could have worked just fine if my employer would have accommodated my multiple sclerosis, and the doctor suggested several accommodations, modified job duties, modified schedule, an occupational therapist consult that would have helped the employee. The employer refused to do those and instead said, no, just go on Social Security. And the court said, well, no, that employee did give a sufficient reason to explain any apparent type of inconsistency between his claim under the ADA and his receiving Social Security benefits. In the Crensavage case, the court held that a plaintiff's ADA claim is barred as the only accommodation she requested was extended unpaid leave, and there was no showing that that accommodation ever would have let her become qualified. So in that case, because in some ways the accommodation requested may have been unreasonable, the court held that that exception regarding the ADA considering reasonable accommodations in Social Security law, not considering them, could not be used by that employee because they did not really request an accommodation that would have allowed them to be qualified. And then in Cruz versus Dow Chemical, a physician's assessment that the employee was indefinitely incapable of returning to work precluded an ADA claim because the employee was not a qualified individual, and that's why it's very important for employees to be careful of what their doctor's note says when they're seeking accommodations, or in some cases if they're going before SSA, if they also have an ADA claim. But here the doctor said the employee was indefinitely incapable of returning to work, and clearly the court said, well, that means that they're not qualified. In a couple more cases, in Butler versus Round Lake Police, a police officer with chronic obstructive pulmonary disease told the pension board he could barely walk a few blocks or climb stairs and was not reinstated. And this kind of relates to the factual types of statements I was pointing out earlier. And the court held that he's therefore stopped from claiming that he was qualified for the job because he told the pension board that he was unable to do essential functions of his job, walking, climbing stairs, etc. And in this case, too, I just wanted to point out that the Cleveland case was used, but even though it wasn't Social Security benefits, it was pension benefits, and it's been used also in settings of long-term disability types of benefits as well. And then the Solomon case under the Federal Employees Retirement System. Under that system, disability benefits are only awarded if there are no reasonable accommodations, and the employee to collect must be unable, because of disease or injury, to render useful and efficient service. And the court held that if someone is receiving benefits under this federal employee retirement system, that precludes them from making the argument that, well, they could have done the job if they were accommodated, because the only way to receive those benefits is if there are no accommodations that would enable the person to do their job. And then the last Cleveland case we'll talk about here is Finian. This individual had some seizures in meetings due to epilepsy. He did return to work and was eventually terminated for poor performance. And then, as often happens, after the unemployment ran out, they applied for Social Security benefits. And the Social Security Administration, in their hearing, did not find that Mr. Finian was incapable of performing the essential functions of his job. rather the finding from Social Security was there were not enough, there was not a significant number of jobs in the national economy that he could perform. And this case went to trial, and as you can see, Mr. Finian was awarded $410,000 of back pay and $65,000 in compensatory damages. And his ADA claim was regarded as, the employer said, well, he wasn't a person who was regarded as having a disability. He was a person who had an actual disability, and in fact, the disability rendered him not qualified. And the court said, and remember, this was filed before the ADA Amendments Act, so it was kind of the lower standard for definition of disability. The court said, no, these laws have different definitions. Social Security himself never said that he couldn't do the essential functions of his job. They just found that after he was terminated, there weren't enough jobs in the national economy that he could do. And also pointed out one of the other reasons that Mr. Finian's condition did change over time. And for these reasons, the jury verdict was upheld. And I just want to briefly mention some of the other Supreme Court cases, which are covered in a little more depth in the brief. We just wanted to pick the main ones to talk about. There's Board of Trustees of the University of Alabama versus Garrett, which held that state employees are not entitled to money damages due to the immunity applied or given to states under the 11th Amendment, but that state employees may get injunctive relief. And the 11th Amendment will come up, as we'll see, in Tennessee versus Lane and some other cases. And then there's the Wright case, which the Supreme Court said a collective bargaining agreement that requires arbitration cannot waive statutory rights under the ADA unless the waiver is clear and unmistakable. EEOC versus Waffle House is that the EEOC may seek victim-specific relief even if there is an arbitration agreement that binds the employee. And it's important to remember when the EEOC files a suit, they are representing kind of the people, the government, not necessarily the individual employee themselves, even though they can get relief for that employee. And then the Clackamas case, which we talked about at the last webinar on employee defenses and determining the number of employees under the ADA, we look at the common law, criteria for master-servant relationship, things like degree of control, hiring, firing, supervision, intent of the parties, whose equipment is it used, and share of profits and losses. So I think with that, I am going to unlock my talk key, and I think we'll take a brief break for questions before Barry begins with Title II. Thank you.
Just a reminder that if you do want to ask questions, you just need to either type the question into the box or press the control key and then go ahead and speak. It does appear we have some confusion regarding how people can get the brief and the PowerPoint and whether people are registered or not. Claudia or Peter, I don't know if you want to address that so folks can understand better that process.
The PowerPoint and the legal brief, as I wrote in the chat area, will be emailed to everyone that registered. All those that did not register, you are welcome to participate in the session. It is a free session. We just ask that you do go through the process for future sessions and register. This helps us keep track for statistical purposes and funding purposes of who's participating, and those numbers will help keep this program going. So please make the effort to register. You will still be able to access the session, the recording, and the materials, but you will have to wait 10 days. When we archive the session, and then you'll visit the archive page on the ada-audio.org for the legal webinar section, and you can view the recording there. The transcript will be posted as well, but you will need to wait at least 10 days while we edit and upload that. But just want to emphasize, please register. That helps us keep this program growing and keep in order as to who's getting the materials and the information.
Thanks, Claudia. Any questions on the Title I cases that Alan asked? Again, all you need to do is type into the chat box or press the control key and then talk. Okay, well, it looks like there aren't any questions at this time, so why don't we go ahead and we'll start with Titles II and III and have that discussion, and we'll have time at the end for people to ask questions about those cases as well as any that come to you regarding Title I as well.
Hi, Barry. I just want to point out a comment that Kimberly posted there, and she's wondering about the connection between Cleveland and the picture. So she's talking to Alan there in his graphics that he likes to load.
Right. I know, thanks for the reminder. Peter indicated that we should probably repeat the questions in the chat box for accessibility purposes. And Alan had talked about a picture that was in the Cleveland section, and it turns out that that was Ian Hunter of Mott the Hoople, who wrote Cleveland Rocks, which is I don't know, a song I think I remember from the Drew Carey Show. So with that trivia out of the way, why don't we move to Titles 2 and 3. Interestingly, unlike the Title 1 cases where plaintiffs mostly lost, the Supreme Court has issued much more favorable decisions under Titles 2 and 3, and I'm going to be talking about two cases under Title 2 and two cases under Title 3, and in all of those cases, the plaintiffs were successful. So the first case is Olmstead versus LC, and people may know that when Congress passed the ADA, they found that isolation and segregation was a serious form of discrimination under the ADA, and that state and local governments under Title II had a responsibility not to exclude people from their programs, provide program access, and then also provide modifications to those programs as necessary. And then Congress also directed the Department of Justice to issue regulations on Title II, and one of the regulations they issued has been commonly referred to as integration mandate, because what Department of Justice said is that state and local governments have a responsibility to provide their services in the most integrated setting, and went on to talk about making modifications to programs. They did indicate a limitation on that, saying that modifications don't have to be made if it would somehow fundamentally alter the state or local government program. And then that leads us to Olmstead versus LC, and I'm sure many of you are familiar with this case. Real briefly, it was not a class action. It was actually brought on behalf of two women in Georgia with mental illness and intellectual disabilities, and they had been admitted to a state psychiatric hospital. And after they had been treated in the hospital, the state officials recommended that both of them could be placed in a community-based program, and they clearly wanted to move into the community. Unfortunately for them, in Georgia, there weren't sufficient community services available to accommodate their request, and so they remain in the institution. LC stayed for 3 years, and EW 1 year when they filed suit. So they did file suit claiming that the state was violating the ADA by failing to provide community services, and they brought suit under Title II. And so the Supreme Court ultimately decided this case, and some people compare this case to Brown versus Board of Education for the African American community, in that it talks about that unwarranted institutionalization or segregation is inherently discriminatory. Separate is not equal, and found that that is a form of discrimination under the ADA. And the court talked about that segregation perpetuates unjustified assumptions about people with disabilities who are in institutions, that they're incapable or unworthy of participating in community life. They also talked about that inherently institutional confinement can severely diminish people's life, and they gave examples of different aspects of everyday lives that are diminished by being in a large congregate facility, like family relations, social contacts, work, educational advancement, and cultural enrichment. The court then said that there's really three requirements that people have to meet in order to receive the community placement under the ADA. And the first one is that treatment officials find that community placement is appropriate for the person, just like they had found for the plaintiffs in the Olmstead case. Second, that the person does not oppose placement in the community. And again, both the plaintiffs in Olmstead clearly wanted to live in the community. And then the third requirement is that placement can be reasonably accommodated, taking into account the resources of the state and the needs of others with disabilities for services. So you don't look at people in a vacuum. You really look at it overall, the different services that are being provided by the state and all the different people that the state is obligated to serve. And the way that the subsequent cases have played out, it's really this third requirement where we're going to be seeing the bulk of the litigation. Next slide, please. Thanks. The court also gave the state some guidance on how they can meet their obligations under the ADA. And they said that if a state has what's called a comprehensive, effectively working plan for evaluating people and placing people with disabilities in less restrictive settings, and a waiting list that moves at a reasonable pace that's not controlled by the state's endeavors to keep the institutions fully populated, then the state will be able to show that they have met their obligations under Title II and the Olmstead decision. And what we'll see is that the comprehensive, effectively working plan issue is, ultimately becomes an issue for litigation. Another issue that's arisen under the Olmstead case is really who can bring suit to enforce their rights under Title II. You'll remember the Olmstead facts involved two people who were actually residents in an institution. But the question arose, what about people who are at risk of institutionalization, meaning people who are without community services, aren't living in an institution, they're living in the community, but they don't have services from the state, and so therefore they have no other option than to move into a large congregate setting to get the services they need. The typical scenario here is an adult oftentimes living with aging caregivers and who are at risk of institutionalization if perhaps that caregiver can no longer provide the support that person needs, that they are at risk of institutionalization. And generally, since the Supreme Court decided Olmstead, courts have extended the Olmstead decision to include people who are at risk of institutionalization. Excuse me. Going back to the slide, I'm not finished there, Alan, thank you. The Fisher case is a good example of the at-risk of institutionalization concept. This was a case involving the state of Oklahoma, and they had been providing unlimited prescription drugs to people living in the community on Medicaid, as well as people in nursing homes and other institutional settings. But because of budget reasons, the state of Oklahoma decided to cap the prescription drugs to a certain number, 5 prescription drugs. If you were in a community program, they did not provide the same cap for people in nursing homes. And in fact, you had unlimited prescription drugs if you were in a nursing home. And so the plaintiffs here were people who were living in the community who were receiving more than 5 prescription drugs. And they claimed that the state's cap here was a violation of the ADA because the medication limits placed them at risk of institutionalization. And in response to this claim, the state of Oklahoma and actually the lower court said that these people did not have an ADA claim because they were not currently institutionalized and therefore didn't have standing to bring the suit. And the Tenth Circuit disagreed with that and said that the integration mandates protections aren't limited to those who are currently institutionalized, but, and I quote the language here, also those who stand imperiled with segregation because of a state policy, therefore at risk of institutionalization. And so as a result, the court found that they could bring suit under Title II, even though they currently weren't in an institution. And you'll see several cases listed here, and there are more in the brief that go into this at risk of institutionalization. The most recent case is one out of Hawaii, where Hawaii decided to change from a fee-for-service plan to a managed care plan, reducing the services that people with disabilities were able to get. And they claimed that they were at risk of institutionalization because of the reduction in community disability-related services. This concept of at risk of institutionalization has really it's been well established since the Olmstead decision, but it's really become much more prominent recently because of the recession, and many states are cutting their budgets, and these cuts are including cuts to community placements for people with disabilities. So as these cuts have been coming down, people have been brainstorming what is the legal theory to try to prevent those kinds of budget cuts. And one of the legal theories that really has emerged is using the ADA and claiming that these cuts of community programs are placing people with disabilities at risk of institutionalization, and therefore the states are violating Title II if they make those cuts. And the VLV Wagner case is a really good example of this sort of recent new emerging case law using the at-risk of institutionalization because of budget cuts. This is a case out of California, and the state of California was proposing to reduce or terminate some in-home services that were being provided for people with disabilities and the elderly. And the case indicated that if the cuts went through, about 36,000 people were going to lose all their services in the community, and almost 100,000 people would lose some significant services. So a suit was filed to try to prevent these cuts, and the argument was that the state was violating the ADA because the the cuts would place the plaintiffs at risk of institutionalization. And the court granted what's called a preliminary injunction, finding it was likely that the plaintiffs would be successful. And the preliminary injunction prevents the budget cuts from taking place while the litigation is pending. And the court found that that these budget cuts could violate the ADA's integration mandate. They talked about that it would increase there would be an increase in more expensive hospitalization and institutional care, and that increase would likely outweigh any short-term savings that the state would get from making these cuts. So the court was indicating that that it would be hard to maybe have that fundamental alteration cost defense because of the increased cost in institutional care and hospitalization that would arise. Though the state made an interesting argument. They said that that people with disabilities really weren't at risk of institutionalization because many of them had family members that could assist them and care for them, even if the cuts went through, and so therefore they weren't really at risk of institutionalization. And the court didn't accept that argument. You know, they said that this is really the state's ultimate responsibility, whether or not people have family members or other caregivers who are willing to sort of sacrifice their own resources and time to assist people, that it really is the state's responsibility. The other thing that was interesting here was when you try to get a preliminary injunction, you have to show a risk of imminent harm. And the court here said that institutionalizing people with disabilities who can live in their home with supports would likely cause injury to their physical and mental health, including shortened lifespans and even death. So certainly a very serious imminent harm that was projected here and viewed by the court. Next slide. As I mentioned in the Olmstead case, the state can show that it's met its ADA obligations if they can demonstrate that they have what's called a comprehensive, effectively working plan for people with disabilities. And initially, there wasn't a lot of litigation on this issue, but developments in recent years have shed some light on what this term, comprehensive, effectively working plan, really means. The most recent case looking at this is Disability Advocates, Inc. versus Patterson, a case out of New York. This was a case that went to trial last year against the state of New York, and it was brought on behalf of people with mental illness who are living in large privately run but state-funded facilities. They're called adult homes. And ultimately, the court found for the plaintiffs, finding that New York had violated the ADA. Just to back up on these homes, they're really large institutional settings that have usually more than 100-person per facility, and had inflexible routines that limited personal autonomy, didn't allow people to interact with other people who didn't have disabilities. And although the state argued that these weren't institutions because they were actually located in residential neighborhoods and people could leave, even though there were some restrictions, the court said that these are, you know, that Olmstead is not limited to state-operated facilities, but also includes state-funded facilities that are privately run and managed, and oftentimes some of these places are even for-profit. And arguably, those facilities have even more incentive not to provide community services, and because of the fact that that they have a financial incentive to keep their beds fully populated. So in addition to the comprehensive effectively working plan issue, this case is also, I think, very helpful in explaining that Olmstead is not limited to just state-operated facilities. But moving on to the next slide, the court did also go on and talk about what's required for a comprehensive effectively working plan, which they found the state did not have. And you see here four factors that are common that they should have as a bare minimum to have one of these comprehensive effectively working plans. Those factors are a time frame or target date for placement in community settings, the approximate number of residents to be placed within a particular time period, eligibility for placement, as well as a description of the collaboration that's going on between the local authorities and all the different services like housing and transportation, education, those kinds of things. There was an earlier case that's in the brief that from the Third Circuit, the Frederick L. case, and that goes into some of these factors in even more detail. I see that Barbara has a question about whether Disability Advocates Inc. case has been appealed. It actually isn't complete. It was bifurcated liability and remedy stage. So the court has already found that there was liability, that they violated the ADA, but a remedy hasn't been issued by the court. So the trial stage is technically not over. And after that remedy is issued, then we'll have to watch to see if it's appealed or not. Another case that looked at the comprehensive working plan and also the issue of fundamental alteration that I referred to before is the Crabtree case, and this is a case out of Tennessee. And it's similar to the VL case in that it was a case involving budget cuts that impacted people in the community and they were at risk of institutionalization. And here the court found that the state did not have the comprehensive effectively working plan here. They said it lacked a projected date for implementation. It wasn't operational. So although there were some written documentations that the state pointed to as a plan, the court said it really didn't have that. There is a case in the brief, Braddock versus Ark of Washington out of the Ninth Circuit, where the court found that that the state did have a plan. So if you're looking for cases that go the other way, you'll find that in the brief. The Crabtree case also talked about the concept of fundamental alteration. Interestingly, the early cases in Olmstead found that many of them found that any type of short-term additional cost could potentially be a fundamental alteration, which sort of was making that defense very, very looming. And the subsequent cases that have looked at this have taken a narrow have taken a different view of fundamental alteration, saying that if every expense that would be required to provide community services, even short-term expenses, would result in a fundamental alteration, it really takes away the integration mandate. So although the initial cases were indicating that fundamental alteration would happen with really any expense, additional expense incurred, most of the more recent cases have backed off of that more narrow interpretation. And here you'll see on Crabtree some factors to look at when whether the fundamental alteration defense arises. With the first one, the state's ability to continue meeting the needs of other institutionalized patients being the most prominent one. Mainly, the courts are saying that any kind of plan has to be specific and measurable to show, the commitment to deinstitutionalization and which the state can be held accountable. And in the Crabtree case, they found that Tennessee didn't have that kind of plan. And then the last case on fundamental alteration is a case out of Illinois, Radishevsky versus Merrim. And this is another case involving at-risk of institutionalization. And this was a young man who had significant disabilities. He was getting nursing care under a children's Medicaid waiver program for kids who were considered, quote unquote, medically fragile. And he was getting about 16 hours of nursing care. But when he turned 21, the adult program in Illinois limited nursing care to 5 hours, and so he was arguing that he was at risk of institutionalization because he wouldn't be getting the services he needed. And you'll see on the next slide that the state said that serving him in his home was a fundamental alteration, and therefore it wasn't required to provide that same level of care. But the case went up to the Seventh Circuit initially, and the court said, we don't see a fundamental alteration here. The state's already providing this service. It's not a new service. They just need to provide more of it, and they could clearly provide it for kids, so why can't they do it for adults? The case ultimately went to trial, and they found that the case of the plaintiffs was even stronger because of they showed that it would be much less expensive for the state to serve the plaintiff, continue to serve the plaintiff in his home rather than the nursing home. There have been subsequent cases in Illinois on the same issue. The policy hasn't changed, and you'll see citations for those, and we actually litigated those two, and we're litigating another case, Stegmeier, which is currently pending because the state of Illinois has not changed this policy. So those are really the major issues that have been that litigated under Olmstead. Now let's turn to the other Title II case, which is Tennessee versus Lane. As Alan alluded to, the Supreme Court found that states are immune from Title I cases that are brought against states for money damages, and the reasoning being that the court found that there was insufficient evidence of a history of employment discrimination by states, and therefore they weren't going to waive to take away the sovereign immunity that states have. But Garrett was clearly limited to Title I employment cases. So the question was, what about Title II? our state's immune from Title II cases as well. And Tennessee versus Lane is the case that really addressed that issue. It involved two individuals from Tennessee who were trying to get in courthouses that were inaccessible. One of the persons was a court reporter with a disability, and the other was somebody who was there, a defendant who was facing misdemeanor charges. And at first he crawled up the stairs and then finally refused to crawl up because he couldn't get in, and ultimately filed suit under the ADA Title II. And Tennessee argued that they're immune under Title II, and that Garrett should be extended to Title II as well. And the plaintiff said we should at least get injunctive relief like you had under Garrett, but we should also get money damage as well, because there was a stronger history of discrimination by states under Title II. And the Supreme Court agreed with the state of Tennessee with respect to this issue and said that that at least with respect to courthouse access, they found that that Title II did appropriately abrogate the state's immunity here. And just to back up, to take away the immunity, Congress first has to expressly show that it intends to take away the immunity, and they did so in the ADA. And then it's taken away if you can show that if the remedy that the statute provides is what's called congruent and proportional to the injury involved. And here the court found that there was extensive history of discrimination involving state and local government, and not only did they look at court issues, but they looked at other issues of state-sponsored discrimination against people with disabilities in a variety of areas, including voting and education. And so ultimately they found that you could get money damages in this case. But again, they did limit it, the specific remedy, to courthouse access. And so if you go to the next slide, what this raises is, what about other types of Title II services? Are they are states subject to litigation for money damages under those as well? And it really has depended on the type of issue, and even within the issue, there's been some split in the courts. The case of Brewer on this slide, Brewer versus Wisconsin Bar Examiners, involved a woman who was applying to be an attorney, getting her bar application, and she disclosed that she received Social Security benefits that tipped them off that she was a person with a disability, and they required her to undergo a psychological evaluation, which she refused to do. And ultimately, she sued under Title II because she couldn't get her bar license. And the court did not agree to extend Lane to this context, because they said that there really wasn't any history and pattern of discrimination regarding attorney licensing schemes. It was much different, the court said, than access to courts, where there was much greater history. And so they said there was no waiver here of sovereign immunity. Another case that raised this issue is involved courts, but a little different aspect of courts, which was jury duty. In this case, you had a prosecutor who there were two prospective jurors who were blind, and he decided to use his peremptory challenges to not have them on the jury because he had a lot of visual aspects to his presentation. And the defendant in that case, who had a disability as well, felt like that unfairly prejudiced him, and that took people with disabilities off of the jury, at least two people who were blind. And he claimed that this, under Lane, that jury service is similar to courthouse access. And the court did not agree with that. They said, you know, this peremptory challenges have been upheld, although the peremptory challenges of people who are for race or for gender has been not been permitted. The court said that it would allow it here because there was a rational basis as to why they were not allowing the person to serve on the jury. It wasn't discrimination. It was really because they weren't qualified to do the jury service fully because of the visual aspect of the prosecutor's presentation. So although Lane does go to access to the courts and participation in courts, it was not extended to a prosecutor's use of peremptory challenges. One issue where the courts are split is the issue of whether Lane extends to education. And you'll see here we have cases going both ways. The Association for Disabled Americans case, they found that education was a basis for elimination of the sovereign immunity under Title II. This involved students who claimed that the university was failing to provide physical access and sign language interpreters, effective note takers, and so they sued under Title II, and ultimately the court said that yes, Lane should be extended to education because there's a long history of discrimination in education. And but what you'll see here also are some other cases that go the other way, particularly the Johnson case out of Connecticut, which says that education is not a fundamental right and it's different than access to courts. And so this is an issue that you'll see courts going both ways, and maybe one that ultimately the Supreme Court has to clear up because of the split in the circuits. The other Title II cases that are in the brief are the Yeske case, which said that Title II protects state prison inmates, the Buchanan case, which said that you can't get attorney's fees under the ADA unless you have a judgment, consent decree, or some sort of judicial stamp of approval of the case. The Barnes case, which said that punitive damages aren't allowable under Title II or 504. And then the U.S. versus Georgia case, which is an extension of the Lane case to the concept of discrimination in prisons, where they found a violation of the 14th Amendment. But in the remaining time, why don't we move to Title III? There's two cases we're going to focus on in Title III, the Bragdon versus Abbott case and PGA Tour versus Martin. You might remember the Bragdon case was the first ADA case decided by the Supreme Court. It was under Title III, and this was the case involving a woman with HIV whose dentist refused to treat her in his office, said that they had to have the dental services done in a hospital setting, and it would cost more money, and it was a further drive for her. And so she sued under Title III. And it really raised a couple of questions. The first question was whether she had a disability or not. And the dentist said she doesn't have a disability. She's asymptomatic HIV. She can't show she's substantially limited in major life activity. And she said, yes, I am limited in the major life activity of reproduction. I've chosen not to have kids because I don't want to infect my sexual partner or pass it on to my unborn child. And the Supreme Court agreed that reproduction is a major life activity. It wasn't one that was necessarily in the regulations, but the court found that it is a major life activity. And the court said that even that major life activities don't have to be public or economic or daily in order to be major. And this was an important concept, as we'll see in some of the subsequent cases. The other thing I wanted to say on Bragdon before we move on is the court also looked at the issue of direct threat. The dentist was saying that it was a threat to his safety to serve somebody with HIV, and the court said that the analysis hadn't been done below correctly, that you need to look at the best available medical or objective evidence and not speculate or based on generalizations or stereotypes or even good faith. That wasn't enough in determining whether it was a direct threat, and so they sent that back down for further analysis. The other thing I just wanted to mention is that with respect to the major life activity of reproduction, this shows that the list of activities in the ADA regulations is not exhaustive. So even though some things are listed, courts can recognize additional major life activities as well. So the subsequent cases that have come down since Bragdon, how have they been applied in the lower courts, the Bragdon case? The Fiscus case, I think, is a great example of how Bragdon has been applied outside the facts of HIV. This was involving an employee who had renal disease, and what she ended up saying was that she was substantially limited in the major life activity of cleansing her blood and eliminating bodily waste. And the courts extended Bragdon and said, you know, just like how asymptomatic HIV, even though it's not an external symptoms or external activity, it doesn't matter. If it similarly in for kidney disease, it doesn't matter if it doesn't have to be external. It can be an internal autonomous activity. You're not required to show that the activity is recurrent or a daily feature of life, and the issue is not the frequency of the activity, but the importance to the life of the individual. So obviously cleansing the blood and eliminating bodily waste is a very important activity for that particular individual, and so they found it to be a major life activity. And this is really a precursor, I think, to the major bodily functions that Congress recognized in the ADA Amendments Act. You'll recall that in addition to major life activities, Congress has now put a list of different major bodily functions that I think the Fiscus case really came up with before the ADA Amendments Act. The next case is the Lee's Log Cabin, another applying the Bragdon case, and this is sort of a bizarre case factually, so I don't think you want to put too much credence into this case as far as being one that's going to be applied in a lot of different cases just because it has some bizarre things that happen. What happened was a person was not hired allegedly because she was HIV positive, and the complaint was filed on that basis, but then in response to a motion for summary judgment, the EEOC talked about that it was because the person had AIDS and not, they didn't necessarily talk about HIV at that point. People might know that AIDS is really when somebody who has HIV, their T cell count gets below 200 or they have certain opportunistic infections. And the court said, you know, if you look back at Bragdon, Bragdon said that there are no per se disabilities, you still have to have the individualized assessment. And since the EEOC, that HIV and AIDS aren't synonymous, and since AIDS was raised later during the summary judgment stage, it was too late to be considered, and since the summary judgment briefing didn't talk about HIV and how that substantially limited the person in a major life activity, there was really no record of any type of substantial limitation that the court could consider, and so therefore they found that that the person they didn't meet their burden on showing that they had a disability. And the reason this case is here is because it cites to the fact that Bragdon requires an individualized analysis and that no major life activity and impairment is a per se disability under the ADA. Interestingly, though, now we have the ADA Amendments Act and these major bodily functions, and the immune system is considered one of those major bodily functions. So I think we're going to see less plaintiffs having to rely on things like reproduction and instead can just focus on the major bodily function of the immune system as a way to show that they have a disability. You also have the new EEOC proposed regulations which talk about certain types of impairments should be quickly and easily assessed to be a disability under the ADA, and HIV is one of those that's listed. And then the final case we're going to talk about is I'm sorry, I had one more thing I just wanted to mention on Bragdon. There are a couple of other cases that I think are in the brief that aren't here that are important to note. One is that the concept of reproduction has been extended to other conditions other than HIV, that being hepatitis C as another impairment that's found to be a disability under the ADA, under the major life activity of reproduction. The other way that Bragdon has been extended is to cases where sexual activity was alleged and not reproduction. There's the McClendon case in the brief where a person with mental illness did not engage in reproduction but did say that they were not able to engage in sexual activity because of impotency that was caused by the mental health drugs that they were on. So even though, again, sexual activity is not one that's listed in the regulations and is now not even listed in the ADA Amendments Act, it is one that courts have recognized and may be something that people can successfully use in future cases. Now let's finally move to the Martin case, PGA versus Martin. And people will remember that this was a case brought by Casey Martin, a golfer, professional golfer, who had a circulatory disorder, and it made it difficult for him to walk long distances. And he had requested that he be allowed to use a golf cart in PGA tournaments because of his circulatory disorder. And the question was whether or not Title III should cover golf tournament participation. And the court ended up saying, yes, it does, that participating in golf tournaments is a benefit and privileges under Title III, and that people who are covered under Title III are entitled to reasonable modifications of policies, like the policy that people have to walk the course rather than riding golf carts. And there was an argument that Title III should be limited to customers, and the court didn't accept that argument, but they said even if it is limited to customers, Casey Martin is a customer, even though he's not sort of paying a ticket to come watch the tournament, he is paying a fee to participate in the tournament, and therefore would fall within the view of what is considered a customer. The court also said, which I think is helpful for future cases brought by plaintiffs, is that the definition of public accommodation should be liberally construed to effectuate the purpose of eradicating discrimination. The court also said that a golf cart, using a golf cart, does not fundamentally alter the nature of tournament golf, and so therefore the modification is something that could be required for the PGA to do. Scalia issued a very lengthy dissent and said that Title III only applies to customers and not contractors, and that Casey Martin was not a customer. So the question after the Martin case was whether the facts were so specific, just about golf, whether it would have any impact on other ADA cases. And it really has come up in a couple of contexts. The first issue is whether or not independent contractors under Title III are covered. And interestingly, although Casey Martin was about golf, most of the cases on this issue involve medical doctors who have staff privileges at certain hospitals. And technically, they're not employees, so they can't bring any discrimination claim under Title I for employment discrimination, but some courts have recognized that they can bring claims under Title III as independent contractors who have privileges that are being denied. So you have two cases here, the Menkowitz case and the Haas case, and both of those involve medical doctors with disabilities who had claimed that they were discriminated against when they lost their privileges, and the court found that both of these did have standing under Title III. They couldn't bring under Title I because they weren't employees, but that they were denied the enjoyment of the privileges of the hospital and therefore had standing to bring suit under Title III. The case that goes the other way is the Wojcicki case, which found that Title III should not be extended to independent contractors. Interestingly, the Wojcicki case relied upon Scalia's dissent in the Martin case, which is kind of odd to be using the dissent as your legal argument, but at least in this particular case, they said that that was appropriate. You should also note that there are some Section 504 cases, and most recently one out of the Ninth Circuit, Fleming versus Yuma Regional Medical Center, that have allowed independent contractors to be covered under Section 504. So entities that receive federal funding might be subject to a 504 claim as well as a Title III claim. And then the other issue that the Martin case looked at is whether or not it was the issue of fundamental alteration, was providing the modification in the walking the course policy, was that a fundamental alteration defense that the PGA could raise? And as we mentioned before, they found that it was not a fundamental alteration. So in subsequent Title III cases, there have been arguments that that changing policies would be a fundamental alteration. And some of these are involving sports like golf. So the Kuketz case is a case involving a person who used a wheelchair who was a racquetball player, and he had asked for a change in the game rules, saying that he needed to be allowed two bounces in racquetball rather than just the traditional one. And the court ultimately said that that would be a fundamental alteration, and therefore the requested modification was not required, because unlike the Martin case that did not go directly to the game, they found that this went directly to the rules of the game and the actual playing of the game, as opposed to the walking between the holes in Martin. And so they found that that was a fundamental alteration, unlike the Martin case. And then the next case, the Association for Disabled Americans case, involved a person who wanted to play, wanted to change the way table was set out in the game of craps. I'm not a golfer, so I'm not a golfer, but I'm also not a gambler. But apparently, in craps, there's a standard size table, and they asked for the table to be changed and modified and lowered so that the person could participate in the craps game. And the court ultimately said that that would be an unfair advantage to people with disabilities if you could throw the dice at a lower angle. I'm not really sure why that's an advantage or not, but that's what the court said. And so, again, unlike the golf cart in Martin, which didn't provide an unfair advantage, they found that this requested modification it would be an unfair advantage and therefore a fundamental alteration. And I see that Alan has indicated he's a golfer and a gambler, so he can help you out with those questions that you have. And then the last case here is the 14 case, which is a movie theater case. And this was a case involving a person in a wheelchair and their companion who went to go see a movie. I believe it was Chicken Run. And although the theater had accessible seating spaces for wheelchairs and then companion seatings next to it, and other people had sat in those companion seats, and they said, we'd like you to move those people from the companion seats, the people who weren't companions of the person with disability, and the movie theater refused. And they said, you know, we have a policy that if we have a high-selling movie, that we don't require people to move out of the companion seats. And they sued and said you should modify that policy for people with disabilities. And ultimately, the court agreed that they should have modified that policy, and they issued an injunction that said that people have to move out of those companion seats within 10 minutes of the showing of the movie, and it was not a fundamental alteration. And then the only other case that we have listed here for Title III, which we're not going to talk about today, is the Spectre case, which is a case involving foreign flag cruise ships, and that's in the briefing. You can get the information there. So just wanted to mention the ongoing sort of ADA issues that we have that are remaining that maybe even turn into future Supreme Court cases. One being that whether or not reassignment should be an automatic placement, the one that Alan talked about in the Barnett case. Another is the one that I just mentioned about the coverage of independent contractors under Title III. There's a split in the courts there. Also, how does Lane get extended beyond courtroom access? As we saw in education, the courts are split on that issue, and there's other topics that might arise under state and local government services that might arise in the future as well. There's a whole provision of the ADA which has not gotten to the Supreme Court, medical inquiries and confidentiality. It's something that is an issue that arises in a lot of different contexts, but it's not one that the Supreme Court has looked at. And then also whether or not there's a direct threat to self-defense. Do you extend the Achazbal case that Alan spoke about beyond Title I? Would it apply to Title III or possibly even Title II? And then the other thing is to watch the EEOC regulations under the ADA Amendments Act when they're released. They may provide additional guidance on some of the issues that have come from some of these Supreme Court cases over the years. So we only have a couple minutes left, but we didn't have any questions before, but why don't we see if we have any final questions before we wrap it up. You will see here about the information about the next session, which is going to be on April 7th, and we'll be doing an update on reasonable accommodation issues. We'll be looking at the most recent case law and talking about those issues. Regina, I see your question saying, will the brief talk about where the splits are? And when we're talking about the splits, we're talking about splits in the lower courts interpreting the Supreme Court cases. And yes, the brief does talk about where there are splits and how different courts are interpreting some of these issues. Just a reminder that if you do have a question, just press your control key or type in your question. Well, it doesn't look like we have any questions here now. Peter, maybe you can answer this. There's a question about the website where people can go with all the different information for the future things. I can answer that. It's www.ada-audio.org. It's on the lower left-hand side of the screen here that you have on this. And Susan has a question about Olmstead. It says, have you seen cases applying the Olmstead Community Integration Mandate to medical supplies and Medicaid? I haven't seen that specifically, but I think it's a reasonable extension of the Fisher case where it talked about prescription drugs. So there may be cases out there that I'm not aware of, but I think if there are future cases like that, and you would show that if the person can't get the medical equipment that they need, that they would be at risk of institutionalization, I think it would apply. I see that Marna has a question. What reasons were given for the person needing two bounces in racquetball? The case didn't go into a lot of detail, but basically it just was saying that because of mobility issues with the wheelchair, it was hard for him to basically hit the ball without an extra bounce. At least that was his perspective. Other wheelchair racquetball players may not think they need that extra bounce, but that's something he said that he needed. Peter has a question. Do you see Bragdon being used to argue against the presumed list in EEOC regulations because of case-by-case language? You know, if you look at least my interpretation of the EEOC is saying that it's not necessarily presumed, but it says that it should be easy and quick. And so I think there's still – the EEOC is not throwing out or proposing to throw out the individualized assessment. It's just saying you shouldn't have to spend much time improving on certain impairments that are almost always should be considered disabilities.
And Barry, someone wanted to know, has the disability advocate's case been appealed?
Yeah, I think I answered that one, but just to be clear, that was a case where there was two stages of the case. There's the liability stage, which has been completed, and now the remedy stage, where the court is deciding what the actual remedy will be. So the case is actually not finished at the trial court level, but will be eligible for appeal, I suppose, once the court issues a remedy. Janice has a question about Olmstead cases about people's right to remain in institutions. There's actually a case, I'm not remembering what it is. Others on the line here might be able to remember the name of the case. But I think there was a case, I seem to recall it being out of Pennsylvania, which said you do not have a right under the ADA to remain in an institution that doesn't work that way. Stacy, the evaluation is on the form right in front of you. You'll see that there's a link there that has an evaluation. Any final questions that people have? Martha, hi, it's good to see you. Yes, actually, Department of Justice has become, I think, very involved in Olmstead issues. As a disability rights advocate, we're very excited to see that. They actually just filed a brief in our Olmstead case in Illinois, the Ligas case. They also moved to intervene in the disability advocates case from New York that I mentioned. They filed a brief in Connecticut and I think even a couple of other cases as well. So the disability rights section, I think, has Olmstead as a very high priority now and is getting very involved. It'll be interesting to see if they do initiate some new cases on their own, but they're definitely being active in ongoing cases that are out there right now.
All right. Thank you very much, Barry and Alan, for all the great information. Again, folks, please remember to complete the evaluation for today's session. Barry mentioned the next upcoming session looking at the issue of reasonable accommodation. Upcoming in April, please visit the ADA Audio Conference website, www.ada-audio.org, to register for that session. Registering in advance for the sessions guarantees that you will get copies of the materials immediately following the sessions. So I want to thank all of the participants for joining us today. To exit the conferencing system, you just need to close your internet browser. Thanks, Barry. Thanks, Alan.